Accession number 27807, Mr. Harry Hooper, Reel 13. Now, what happened after the end of the war in August? You said, in a sense, you were disappointed. You felt you hadn't done all you wanted to do. But what actually did happen to you? Because, I mean, it certainly wasn't the end of your RAF time, was it?
No, it wasn't. Well, for the first couple of 3 months after the war, we practiced bombing and fighter affiliation, formation flying, low-level flying, and we realised that our Squadron 115 had been posted as part of the Tiger Force, which was being assembled to go out to the Far East and join with the Americans in the assault on Japan. During that period, we moved from Wychford to Gravely, just up the road from us, and there we met 35 Squadron, who also were going to be part of the strike force on Japan. And we were there only 6 or 7 weeks when the war in the Far East finished with the dropping of the atomic bombs in August and the surrender signing in September. And so Tiger Force was null and void. It was disbanded. Thereafter, I and my crew were posted to 16 ferry unit at Dunkswell in Devon. Not all of my crew went. My bomb aimer, who was 34 or 35 then, was obviously due an early demob, and we left him behind. Similarly, my bomb aimer, my navigator, stayed behind. And at Dunkswell, I picked up a new navigator and a new bomb aimer. And there we did a few air tests on new Lancasters that were to be ferried to the Middle East to replace the Liberators, which were used by 205 Group.
Now, where's Dunkswell?
Dunkswell's in Devon, near Honiton. And we did...
And you went there in September?
Yes, went there in September. And the end of September, and in October mainly, we did consumption tests on several aircraft. And finally, in early November, we set off for the Middle East by way of St. Morgan in Cornwall. We'd only gone off for St. Morgan probably an hour, when we were recalled due to bad weather. But the next day we set off again, and we flew down to Castel Bonito in Libya, Tripoli, and we overnighted there. And the next day we flew east along the North African coast over a number of spots which I only knew from war reports, and over the Nile Delta. And our destination was Fayed, which was a sort of gravel-surfaced strip with wooden huts and had been a main RAF base during the war in the Middle East. There we found the squadrons. There were two squadrons on the airfield, and I joined 178 Squadron, which up to that time were flying Liberators, as these had to be repatriated. Of course, they were lease-lend aircraft to the Americans. They were taken to a base on the west side of the Delta, Kilo 40, and I helped ferry one of those. So I got a bit of time in the Liberator. But thereafter, we concentrated on training the Liberator crews on the Lancaster until we were an all-Lancaster squadron. And we practiced cross countries, high-level bombing, fighter affiliation there, until they found something more useful to do, or for us to do. And that was, we were, as the major heavy aircraft units in the Middle East, we were partially converted to passenger and transport flying, or passenger and freight flying.
Now, what did that involve?
Well, what it involved was they left the aircraft intact, except they took the guns out of the turrets, but they installed some tubular structured seats alongside, along each side of the fuses above the bomb bay. And they were eight per side, so we could carry 16 passengers in these sort of elementary seats. They had a canvas back and a canvas sling seat. And we had panniers, which we could load freight and mail into the bomb bays. It was a laborious task, but we used to do it. And therein, we started a series of flights. Some of them were routine flights across North Africa. A typical flight would be we'd go from our base at Fayed to Almaza, the main airport for Cairo, and we'd overnight there until, well, the early hours of the morning, normally about 1 a.m. We flew at night with the passengers because during daytime it was very bumpy, and because there were no oxygen facilities for passengers, we kept below 10,000 feet, normally between 6,000 and 8,000 feet. And during the daytime, that would make it very bumpy and the passengers would feel very uncomfortable. So we flew at night. And a typical route would be from Almaza to El Adam, which was Tobruk, El Adam to Benina, Benghazi, then on to Castel Bonito at Tripoli, and then on to Maison Blanche at Algiers. There we'd overday or overnight, and we'd fly back the next night on the return leg, finish up at Almaza, and then having got rid of our passengers and freight there, we fly back to our base at Fayed.
And what were these flights like? Did you enjoy them?
I enjoyed them immensely because it meant I was seeing new places, and apart from the fact that it was night flying most of the time, there was always some light, and particularly on moonlit nights, there was very little cloud around, so you could see the coastline clearly. And that, having always been interested in the war, and particularly in North Africa, to see these sort of centres where there had been, major engagements with Rommel and before him the Italians, I found it most interesting. We stopped only an hour or so at each place, enough time to offload some passengers and freight, take on new passengers and freight, add them to the manifest, and off we would go.
And what kind of passengers would they be? Just army?
They were mainly military passengers, but also civilians who had to pay for their flight. I don't know how much, but we had proper cargo and passenger manifest for these flights, and everyone was weighed, and we operated like a poor quality airline, I suppose.
And what were the overnight stops like? I mean,
well, typically if we went to Algiers, we'd land there sometimes, in the early hours of the morning or later, depending on takeoff time in Almaza. And there we should have gone to bed, but usually we just went down into Algiers and had a look around, bought the odd thing, and then we flew back the next night. We didn't really, our overnight was an overday, if you like. We should have been in bed during that day, having flown all the night before, but we rarely went to bed, and we just flew back the next night. I mean, people would be horrified today, but that's how it was.
And you carried freight as well as mail?
Yes, we had panniers which were winched up into the bomb bay. And we carried all sorts of freight and mail, especially forces mail and civilian mail and whatever. And whatever the authorities wanted moved from one point to the other. Now, that was a major route. Other routes went from Almaza to Lucca in Malta. We also went up to Ciampino for Rome and above Rome to Treviso in northern Italy, doing the same sort of work. We used to go to Athens, to Hassani Airport. We flew into Palestine on a number of occasions to airfields there, taking military personnel.
I should have checked. Fayed's in Egypt, isn't it?
Fayed is in Egypt, yes. This is the canal zone. The canal zone is really a stretch of land basically west of the canal, on the west bank. And it was a military strip which had been not ceded, but operated by the British military for some time. It was sort of on lease from the Egyptian authorities. And in that area, there were many large army camps, a number of airfields, And there were also some very large POW camps. When we first got out there in December 45, there were many thousand Italians still in camps there, but most of them were working on the airfields. We had Italian batmen, Italian servants on the airfield. We had Italians helping with servicing of the aircraft. And in the mess, we had Italian servants. There were Italians had built most of the blocks that which we were living in. But as they were repatriated there, jobs were filled by German POWs who were still there. In fact, they were still there in 46, end of 46 and into 47. And they did the same task that the Italians had done. They acted instead. They were better, it was thought, than employing local Egyptians. If we got Sudanese up, they weren't so bad, but the Egyptians were somewhat slummocky in their hygiene, and it was thought better to have Italians or Germans working for us. And they, of course, appreciated being out of a camp and living on an airfield, and they could sort of build their own little huts and out of stone blocks and things. They were very ingenious. So living there was quite comfortable. We had quite good food.
I was going to say, what was the mess like?
Well, the mess was quite good. After wartime Britain, I mean, to know that you could have fresh peas and new potatoes every day of the year all the way around, because they could grow two or three crops of peas or potatoes a year in the Delta. It was very good. It was also very cheap. But although the circumstances there for our living circumstances were much superior to anything we had in the UK, we drew an extra allowance for hard lying, which I found somewhat amusing, because it was much better than we'd had in the UK, but we drew an extra 6 or 7 shillings a day for hard living, or hard lying, as they called it. Some of the trips were most interesting. We would go, went to Habania, which was the largest RAF base in the world. An enormous area, runways, and it had its own race course, its own post offices, and it was virtually a small town.
It had been in Iraq.
In Iraq, and had been about, it's northwest of Baghdad, adjacent to Lake Habania. And the RAF had been there since they'd been brought into Iraq to control the area after the army had failed. And they built up this enormous base there. And I don't know how many thousands lived there during the sort of period of the 20s and into the 30s. It had been subjected to an Iraqi attack in 1941. There had been an insurrection in Iraq, and the prime minister, or the current leader of the group, decided he wanted the British out, and they attacked Habania, and the base was defended by some ancient biplanes and a few Oxford training planes, which was all they had at the time. The Germans were at the doors of, well, the Delta at the time, and it was thought that this coincided with the push through to the canal. And with all the British having sort of problems in their at their back door in Iraq, it would be simple for the Germans to go through. However, things didn't work out that way for them, and the insurrection was put down, and things carried on as normal. Habania being the largest training base in the Middle East, people came there and were taught to fly. So that was an interesting trip. We did trips into Palestine, which I also found interesting, various airfields there. And we also had a regular route each week. We took off from Almaza and flew either to Castelbonito or Lucca, and sometimes into Ciampino at Rome, and we flew to Blackbush. And there we left our passengers and freight, whilst we went off for a 24-hour trip home, if we could get home, and we flew back the next day with passenger and freight for the Middle East. And these were highly prized. They were the more senior crews took them. And I suppose in 5 or 6 months, I did about 4 of those trips. don't know. I was able to get home, see my mother and father, then fly back the next day. So all in all, these 205 group squadrons, there were 8 at first. Then they were cut down to 4 and cadre strength, which meant there were only about 20 aircraft totally there and shared between the 4 squadrons. But it was still quite interesting.
Now, anything happened while you were out there?
Well, yes, you realise that by 46 and 47 there was a Jewish insurrection, or revolt as it was called, in Palestine. There had been an Arab revolt before the war, and the Jewish state, which was not yet formed, but was being formed in an underground fashion, decided that they ought to sort of expel the British, although the British were there to defend them and indeed regulate the flow of immigrants to the country. And trips to Palestine were very interesting when I noticed the difference in the airfield defences. We had none in, or needed none really, in Egypt, but in Palestine there were searchlights around the perimeters, guards day and night. We weren't allowed off the airfields. This went on until March, April 47.
So during this period, you just these routine flights.
Yes. Now some of them weren't so routine. One particularly sticks in my mind, which was a trip I did from Egypt down to Aden. I'm not quite sure why the trip was laid on. There were several passengers to Aden, one of whom was a group captain who took his yacht, and we had to strap his small sailing boat beneath the aircraft, and the mast was poked through the back of the rear turret and alongside in the fuselage of the aircraft. And when we got down to Kormaxar, which was the airfield we used in Aden, we got there at night. It was terribly hot. Everyone was sweating profusely. But the next morning I was detailed to fly across to Eritrea on the Horn of Africa to Asmara, the capital. This had been an Italian possession for, since, I don't know, 1896, 1898. And the British military were governing it prior to sort of evicting the Italians gradually back to Italy and allowing the Eritreans to take over their own country. Excuse me, again. It was coming up to Christmas and I flew some frozen pork, frozen poultry to Asmara, which I understood would be for the troops' Christmas dinners. Overnight there, I was told I was flying back to Palestine with some special prisoners, or a group of prisoners, and we were told these were ex or had been Ergenzweiser, Lermai, or Sterngan terrorists. Sorry about this cough. These people had been picked up by the British authorities in Palestine, unable to find enough evidence to charge them. Believing they were terrorists, they would take them, spirit them away, and they were flown down to a sort of concentration camp, I would call it, in Eritrea, until such time as their relatives in back in Palestine forced the authorities to admit that their relative had been spirited away, and they were brought back. And on this occasion, I flew back 16 or 17 of these chaps. They were manacled in chains. We had a sergeant and 4 privates guarding them on the aircraft. I was told that when I got back to Palestine to land at Lida, the airport for Tel Aviv, the main civilian airport, that I was to radio the control tower, tell them I was a special duties flight, and they would know all about it. Unfortunately, when I told them I was the special duty, they knew nothing about it, and we've circled for an hour Eventually I had to land because we were short of fuel. I was told to taxi to the far side of the airfield and stay there until further notice. So I decided to get out of the aircraft, which meant I had to exit through the escape hatch at the top, walk down the fuselage, and I walked across the airfield and saw a wing commander who had appeared. He was in charge of defence and various items on the airfield. And he said he managed to contact the Palestine police and they would be sending Garys out to pick up these so-called terrorists. Meanwhile, they had decided they wanted to get out to relieve themselves, and flying control had given permission to my crew members on the aircraft and the five army guards to allow the prisoners out one at a time to relieve themselves against the wheel. And whilst we were walking across to the airfield, a couple of shots ran out. And when I got over to the aircraft with this wing commander, we found one of these terrorists was on the ground, lying with blood pumping from his groin. Another was sitting on the ground with blood coming from his wrist. And what had happened was that one of the army guards had foolishly left his Sten gun at the foot of the exit or entrance to the aircraft. And my gunner steward, who was sitting at the back of the aircraft, saw it, reached forward for the gun, thinking that if the terrorists got it, they would massacre everyone. And as he picked up the Sten and pulled it rapidly back, the butt hit a former on the aircraft, and a couple of rounds went off. This was typical of the Sten. And unfortunately, one man was killed and another was wounded. This caused a bit of a kerfuffle, as you can imagine, and it hit the headlines in the Palestine Post the next day.
Was there an investigation into it?
Well, there must have been, although I stayed there, I note from my logbook, for about 3 days. Well, nothing really happened. We were just asked what had happened. I didn't know what had happened, but the poor steward, gunner who had acted as the steward on the aircraft, was kept there for some time, and I eventually flew up to Lida and got him back just before Christmas. That was Christmas 46.
So there was no comeback on it.
Was no comeback afterwards. I imagine it was an accident.
Now, were you in 70 Squadron at this time?
I know. No. I'm sorry about that. Yes. I had previously been on 178, and then sometime in late 46 or mid 46, 178 was renamed 70 Squadron. 178 was a wartime squadron, and they were disbanded. So one day we were 178, and the next day it was 70, which was a famous squadron, been in the Middle East from 1920 onwards. In fact,
it was just a change of name rather than
anything. It was, but it was interesting that on one trip to Habana, I was dispatched to Habana to fetch 70 Squadron's mess silver back for the mess at Fayed or Shalufa, I forget which airfield we were at that time. And it was the most splendid amount of silver, it really was. I'd never seen anything like it. And we used it on dining in nights.
What was a dining in night like? How formal was it?
More informal than formal. I mean, we didn't have mess kit or anything like that. We just had khaki uniforms. But we had a set meal, and we had the group captain in charge of the station and the wing commander exec at the table, and the youngest officer would be at the far end, and he would make the loyal toast. But most of it was a sort of chuck-along, as I call it, because bread rolls were thrown up into the fans slowly revolving above, and they whizzed off all round the place, and pudding was thrown about. It was generally a boozy affair, particularly afterwards.
And how were you getting on with it? I mean, were you enjoying your time out there?
I loved it. I loved the weather.
Well, tell me about how was the climate for you?
Well, to me, excuse me, It was always hot and dry. I can't remember there being any rain. I was in Egypt for about 18 months, and I can't remember there being any rain whatsoever the whole time I was there. It was nearly always cloudless, except when we had sandstorms which blew up from the south. They were uncomfortable, but not that bad. The Bitter Lakes, which were part of the Suez Canal, these were two very salty or saltwater lakes, which formed the central part of the canal system. We had a Malcolm Club there where we could go and swim. So all in all, I felt it was a sort of Diluc sort of life.
What about recreations? I mean, was there a club you could go? I mean, what sort of facilities were there for you?
Well, we played rugby. I played rugby. We had RAF Canal Zone rugby, RAF Cairo and RAF Alexandra, and we played various army sides. There being a quite nice stadium with a grass field, call it a field, at Fayed alongside the canal, and we would play our rugby there. There were soccer matches for those that preferred soccer. There was squash. There was a squash court. There was tennis. So, as we, in the summer period, we only worked till 1 p.m., we had the afternoons off. A lot of people just went to bed, but I played tennis, squash, practiced my rugby kicking, and we went swimming. So it was, a marvellous period.
Was there a cinema or anything for you?
There was an open-air cinema, which they erected a large screen, and we sat on the earth or on forms, and perhaps 200 or 300 people watch old American films. I don't remember seeing one of those films through. I had a look and thought, oh, bloody awful, and that was it. But I think that some of the ground staff who'd been out there 4 or 5 years were sort of happy to watch anything at that time.
Any clubs, or was that more in Cairo? And
no, there were officers' clubs in Cairo, and as I mentioned, there was a Malcolm Club for officers on the canal.
And what was the Malcolm Club?
Well, the Malcolm Clubs were formed by Lady Malcolm. I think she was a Lady Malcolm. She sort of pioneered putting recreation facilities up in the Middle East for troops. There were one or two of them dotted around the Middle East. There was one for other ranks and one for officers on the canal, in the canal, or along the canal zone at the lakes. And all they really provided were swimming facilities and or a meal. They had dances. I didn't dance, I didn't go, but there were dances Saturday evening. And I suppose it was almost getting back to a peacetime arrangement. Excuse me.